is the only view out there. There are halachic authorities who maintain that Rashi's famous statement, Yisrael shechata, afal pi shechata, Yisrael, who a Jew who sins, no matter how he sins, he remains a Jew, has to be understood as even applying to an apostate. And even an apostate is supposed to be reached out to in an attempt to bring an apostate back. This dispute has something to do with the question about how the rabbis viewed a person who has so deeply left the Jewish faith that they're now practicing in another faith totally and completely. This, again, is a question about what do we mean when we think about outreach and inreach in the community. When you so deeply have separated yourself from the Jewish community, maybe the answer is that the Jewish community no longer recognizes you as Jewish. So we'll step back and summarize. The Jewish tradition has no notion of outreach among Gentiles. It doesn't think that we're supposed to make Gentiles Jewish. It recognizes only that we're supposed to make the society that's around us moral and monotheistic. We invest resources in doing that for two reasons. First of all, because we bear a religious obligation to make Gentiles moral. And second of all, because we recognize that you can't live in an island surrounded by a cesspool, and that if you do, the cesspool eventually overwhelms you. So when we're called upon to interact with the non-Jewish world, we try our best to preach morality and honesty and integrity and monotheism, because if we preach those activities out there, eventually they'll be preached in here as well. Rabbi Bleich always likes to quote the famous story of the decision to translate the Talmud into German, because there were a group of scholars who wanted to translate the Talmud into German. And they went to Rav Yitzchok Elchanan Spector asking for a haskama, permission to do so. And he wouldn't give them one. He said, Talmud study isn't for Gentiles. And they went to Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch and asked him for a haskama, and he wouldn't give them one, saying Talmud study is not for Gentiles. And they went to Rav Yisrael Salanter, and he promptly wrote them out a letter of approbation encouraging them to translate the Talmud into German. And they asked him why. They told him everybody else wouldn't write out this letter. And he said, well, I have a theory. He said, you'll translate the Talmud into German. The Germans will see how beautiful it is, and they'll all start studying Talmud, because it really is beautiful and intricate. And once the German Goyim are studying Talmud, the Jews will certainly follow. Because, he says, we all know that whatever the non-Jews are interested in learning, we will learn as well. Just as that's true for positive things, that's true for negative things as well, and that we bear some sort of a moral obligation to watch out what goes on around us, because what goes on around us comes into us as well. When it comes to inreach, the rules are completely different. We bear an obligation to make as many Jews as observant as Jewish law as we can, realizing, though, that this is a long-term process and a long-term conversation. You can't undo 50 years of miseducation in a 20-minute conversation, and foolish is the one who tries. And we recognize that the process of outreach entails recognizing that different people are in different stages of observance. How you talk to a deeply committed Jew who occasionally sins because he's overwhelmed with temptation is different from the process of how you talk to an uneducated person who's unaware of the beauty of the tradition, which is different than how you talk to a person who's yeshiva educated and who left in an ideological moment at some point in his adulthood, which is different yet than how you interact with an apostate who consciously left the Jewish tradition and joined another faith. So it's very hard to talk about one tool fitting all goals in inreach. And in fact, if we're to successfully continue the revitalization of orthodoxy, it comes from applying a number of different techniques by a number of different people, all realizing that there's no single answer and there's no single key. Instead, we have to adopt different techniques for different situations. We live in a remarkable age. You want to know what's remarkable about it? 50 years ago, they said we were dead. Do you understand that 50 years ago, they said that orthodoxy was over, and by the year 2004, there'd be none of us left. We would be a quaint group of Hasidim, 40 of us somewhere in Brooklyn, and all of our children would be leaving us. In truth, that's not the way it is at all. There's a profound resurgence in our community. It comes at its core, in my view, from the fact that there's an intrinsic beauty to it. And we're finally producing the tools to share that beauty with others in a successful way. But we're also learning that a tool that shares the beauty with one person doesn't necessarily share that beauty with another person. And we have to develop more complicated, nuanced, complex forms of inReach so as to make sure that different people who come to us with different needs are each treated appropriately, suitable to enhance the long-term commitment of observance to every single Jew in the United States and Canada. Thank you very much, and I'm glad to stay and answer questions.
So for those who have not seen this before, we do put the mic in the middle, and we do ask that questions be directed from the center to our speaker, Rabbi Boyd. I wanted to really express my appreciation. I wanted to open with one perhaps short question, really related to the beginning of your talk when you spoke about outreach to Gentiles and so forth. And you had suggested that, of course, there are different strokes for different folks. You know, there's Jews have a purpose and Gentiles have a purpose, and we ought not to mix them up, and so we don't really do outreach. My question to you is from a theological point of view, doesn't the tradition seem to support the fact that the Jewish role in the world is the real purpose of the world, or the creation of the world, if you will, Sof Masev Machshava Tchila, Yom HaShishi, Beglal Torah that was given on Yom HaShishi, Breishit, Beglal Torah Shenikva Breishit. The whole idea of the Weltanschauung of the world, or the building of the world, leads to the giving of the Torah. And so if you will, and here's the question, and this is somewhat of a devil's advocate that I have the liberty of saying, are not the Gentiles in this approach of Chazal the supporting elements, the supporting cast to the leading lady, which are the Jewish people, or are not the Gentiles really, if you will, the greens around the bouquet of roses? And if that's the case, should we not be reaching out to try to make more people part of that center, or how would they react and we interact with that?
So I want to try to answer that frontally, theologically. There is a strain in Chazal which says that Gentiles are the hedge around the bouquet, and we are the bouquet. I stopped and formulated it the way I do so as to move people away from that view. I don't believe that's a majoritarian view in Chazal, and I certainly don't believe it's the view of the Rambam or most of the Rishonim who pondered it. It's certainly the view of, for example, the Zohar, which centralizes Torah and the Jewish people as the central component of creation. I don't think the Rambam formulates it that way. I can show that the Baal HaTosfos don't, and the Be'er HaGolah, the Maral Miprag, certainly does not. So I deliberately formulated it in a way that rejects this view, because I don't think it's the mainstream view of Chazal. I think that I'll put it in a different story if you want. God's initial desire was to create a world in which there was no Jews, and all creations would be equal in God's eyes, and that failed. So God needed to create a mamlechet konim v'goy kadosh, because most people were not up to the perfect task. But the ideal world would have been a very different construct. I certainly don't deny that you're accurately representing a stream in Chazal. I do think that that's not the majoritarian stream, although it's lock, stock, and barrel, the view of the Zohar. It's the fundamental theme of the Zohar on Bereshit, but it's not the Rambam, it's not the Maral Miprag, it's not a whole group of Rishonim and Achronim who want to conceptualize equal paths up the top of the mountain. Anybody else? Please come to the microphone.
Rabbi Brody, you were talking about outreach to Gentiles. Now, the laws of the Torah are very hostile towards Gentiles. For example, the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, and we come to the low stigma of you should not steal. If a goy steals, he steals less than a pruta, and without a warning, he's decapitated, according to Rambam, Hilchos Malachim. if a Jew, or another example, a Jew kills a Jew, or a Jew kills a Goy, is two different punishments. One is a Jew kills a Jew, he's sentenced by the best, and a Jew kills a Goy is not sentenced by the best. And Hashavas Abeta, we don't have to return a lost object to a Goy. The only reason we do is for a Chilul, that we should not create the hostility towards the Jew, or Chilul Hashem. There's the Lo Techanim, you're not allowed to do a favor to a Goy.
So I'll answer all of them in one fell swoop.
Sure, please.
You ready?
Thank you.
I don't believe the punishments required by the Sheva Mitzvahs are minimal. I think they're maximal, and that the non-Jewish law allows punishments less than the maximum penalty imposed. So although the punishment for theft can be the death penalty, Halacha allows the courts that enforce the Sheva Mitzvahs to apply a penalty less than death. The more general question that you ask has to do with halachic recognition of discrimination between Jews and non-Jews. That's a more complicated problem. My general view is that all of these focus on reciprocity. And that, for example, let's talk about Hashavas Aveda. The halacha goes as follows. A Jew has to return the property of another Jew that's lost. A Jew doesn't have to return the property of a Gentile. What do we do in a society where Gentiles are duty-bound to return lost property as well? So the Ramah says we then return everybody's lost property. In my view, the key to understanding most of the discriminatory aspects of halacha have to do with reciprocity, which is if we live in a society where Gentiles don't return lost property, we don't return lost property to them. If they create a society that returns lost property, we are glad to return their lost property. The question about killing is a more technical question, because halacha recognizes the right of a non-Jewish society to kill a Jew who kills a non-Jew. This is more about what lawyers call civil procedure than it is about underlining values of Jewish law. I think that the central value running in halacha in dealing with Gentiles is the value of reciprocity. We don't want to impose upon the Jewish community obligations to treat Gentiles differently than the obligations the Gentile society imposes upon us. That's why the Ramah always pipes in that where secular law requires a higher level of conduct than that required by Jewish law, we're bound by secular law because that evens the playing field. That's a much longer conversation, but you have to realize that it's unfair to impose upon Jews an obligation to return lost property to everybody if nobody has to return our lost property. Again, think about a society where there are just 10 people, 3 Jews and 7 Gentiles. And every time a Jew loses a piece of lost property, Jews return his property and Gentiles keep it. And every time a Gentile loses a piece of lost property, the Jews would return their property, but the Gentiles wouldn't. What would result from this system is impoverishment of the Jews if everybody loses lost property equally. It would be a slow wealth transfer from the Jewish community to the Gentile community. In Hebrew, they would say, zelo fair. This is not a proper way to conduct oneself. So halacha recognizes at its core reciprocity as the tool. And you can't build a society without a notion of that reciprocity. No, I don't think so. I think the central characteristic is you only return it to a person who returns your lost object. If I encounter a Jew who says, I won't return lost objects, I don't have to return his lost object because he's no longer considered achecha for the purposes of returning lost objects. Achecha denotes reciprocity in this context.
Thank you very much. The hour is moving along, and I'm sure there are many other questions. I really want to thank Rabbi Broit for doing 2 lectures back-to-back. Thank you all for bringing up those cups of water and support liquids for him. But more importantly, I think Rabbi Broit has given us a whole lot of food for thought. The issues of outreach and inreach are surely very complex. He's whetted our appetite, not just with the cups in front, but really intellectually. I want to thank him very much. We also want to encourage you to, we're going to move to our last series for today. Some of you have been here, I know, for an entire day. You may be dragging a little bit, but I do encourage you to stay for the remaining and final session of today's day. Thank you very much.